We're not here to endorse, enforce, change your course. We're not doctors, lawyers, or professional counselors or therapists. Please call those folks directly. This show is meant to get us all comfortable with thinking about our deaths, with thinking about a plan for our loved ones after we've departed, and an idea of what we believe. In doing so, we're forced to look upon our lives. When we do this, we leave with a little more thankfulness, a little more love for ourselves, our lives, our loved ones, and what we've accomplished so far in this short period on Earth. All right. Happy Sunday. Happy Soulful Sunday. How are you, Susan?
I'm good. I'm looking forward to speaking with this EMT lady. There's a lot of questions about what they're required to do. So it'll be nice to have that information.
Yeah, so Susan's most interested in what happens when someone calls the EMT on you and you have a do not resuscitate.
Tattooed
on your chest.
Right. Because nobody's going to go look in your refrigerator when they, you know, everybody says, oh, I have something on my refrigerator. It's like, well, yeah, but do they know that they should first go look on your refrigerator before they break open your chest and break your ribs? And, you know, and again, it's like we're talking about when you're older, not for a young person, but, yeah, you know, what their protocol is, because I've heard too many stories about what they're supposed to do. So now we're going to get the real facts.
Yeah, so my friend is an EMT from Texas, and she's a career EMT, so I'm sure she's going to be able to answer these questions with some, you know, integrity behind her answers, as well as some experience firsthand. We'll see if she's going to call us in a few minutes, but I thought maybe we would take a second to explain what a do not resuscitate is, and how do you get one?
Tattoo.
So, a few months ago, I took Susan to get a tattoo that says DNR, which could be her boyfriend's initials. You know, in the right context, it could also mean don't resuscitate me. So we're gonna ask Deidre that question when she calls in, but.
I read about having it tattooed in an article a doctor wrote about the doctors were doing that. Mm-hmm. And I read this years ago, and I thought, because, you know, there's the chance that the EMT doesn't know.
Right.
So that's why they just tattooed it on their chest, and I thought that was crazy back then, but it made perfect sense now. So.
Well, and two, doctors also know what goes into the process of trying to resuscitate someone.
Yeah. So. And sometimes you reach a point where it's like, don't bother, thank you.
So the do not resuscitate comes from the Advanced Healthcare Directive. That's how you get assigned a do not resuscitate, and that's how you make it legit, is you have an advanced care directive and it's signed by yourself and by your doctor. If it's signed by your doctor, it's more helpful, because if you die, that doctor will sign off on your death, because clearly he understands what your wishes are. He's gone through the conversation with you. If it's some crazy suicide or something like that, that's a different story. But if you're a terminal patient and he knows that you've got X, Y, and Z, and he's signed off on your advanced care directive, then he will also be the person to sign your death certificate. So it streamlines things if you were to die or if this has to go into effect. The second part is that the DNR is not as cut and dry as just don't resuscitate me. It can have some further information on there. So we had a show where we talked about what our advanced care directives would look like, and yours looks different from mine in the aspect that since I'm younger, I would want some intervention. But when it starts to look like, you know, feeding tube and some of these other questions that it goes into, you can start to say yes or no, or ask for a nuance within that. So, you know, some I want resuscitation that is reasonable. But if I'm like flatlining and brain dead, it's probably not very likely that I'm coming back.
Yeah, and we don't, if the EMTs, like we understand it, are just required to keep anybody alive at all costs, and I mean, even if you have an advanced directive, who's going to see it? It's at the hospital, it's in your doctor's office, it's on your refrigerator. So for me, the concern is, how do we let them know before they, you know, from, I don't even know what they do, but I guess they break your ribs and they...
Well, sure. So in the directive, it just talks about, do you want medical intervention? So say you're comatose because you've got staph. And I know that maybe just giving you antibiotics would pull you out of that. I don't feel like that's an intervention that's...
No, of course not.
...bad to do. But if you're in a coma and you've gotten your antibiotics, and then all of a sudden you code, now you're looking at resuscitation and having broken ribs, maybe. I mean, you know, it may or may not work. It may work to the point of, like, you're back, but you're brain dead, you know. And right. So that's where...
No, thank you.
Right, and so that's where you get into the nuances of the advanced directive to sort of say that. So I think it will be interesting to see, because in the field, when you're out there saving lives, you don't have time for these nuances. And so it seems like, right, to me, logically, a call to 911 is exactly that. People are coming, bringing the cavalry, and they're going to save you, or they're going to damn well try as much as they can, because they took that, what's that called, the Hippocratic Oath?
Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's Hippocratic.
Hippocratic. Hippocratic Oath.
Yeah.
So we'll have to ask her about the oath, too.
Yeah, I don't know if EMTs do that.
It seems like a lot of medical professional people do.
But are they, I don't know if they're considered medical professionals. I don't know what they're considered.
I mean,
it's all new to me, but it's time to take a look.
Yep. So let's see. Here's Deidre now. She's calling in. So let's get her on the line.
All right.
Hey there, Deidre. I'm going to put you on the air. One sec. Hold on one. Okay. Can you hear us?
I sure can.
Great.
Loud Hi. And clear. Yeah. Hi.
This is my friend Susan. Susan, this is Deidre Blankenship. Do you still go by Blankenship, Deidre?
Yes, I do. Yeah. Hi, Susan. Nice to meet you.
Really nice to meet you. Thank you so much for coming on the show. This has been a real important question for me at 80 years old, and now we have an authority. So,
yeah. Well, I considered it 47 years old, so it's important that people need to talk about it.
Amen. Yeah. I'm with you, sister.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. See, we got into a minor conversation before the show started, and she said, well, this is more important for me because I'm old. And I said, yeah, but I could die in a horse. I could fall off a horse. I could die on my boat, you know, like anything. She's like, oh, yeah.
Yeah, I hadn't thought of right. it quite that way.
Freak accidents. But
yeah.
We won't get in a discussion about who can have more accidents.
who can die first.
Yeah.
So let's just kind of dive right into it. I mean,
sure.
You're a career EMT, right?
Yes. So I've been in EMS for 28 years now. Wow. I started off as an EMT, and then I advanced my education to be a paramedic. So there's different levels, and that's pretty nationwide. Mm-hmm. So EMTs do basic life support, and then paramedics do all the advanced life support. They're the ones that can actually practice medicine, and we're actually clinicians.
Mm-hmm. So could you explain a little bit more about the difference, like what an EMT can do and what you can do, like what medical stuff?
Sure. So whenever you start out, you know, you go to schooling, you go get your EMT, and you're allowed to do basic life support. So you can do basic airway maneuvers, you know, just like by putting a mask on somebody and squeezing a bag. You can perform CPR. You cannot do anything invasive. So you can't start IVs. You can't, you know, stick tubes down people's throats, and you actually can't push any drugs. There's a few drugs that you can give, but not through an IV. There would just be medications that actually go, like, you know, intramuscular, like if you're having an allergic reaction. They can give oxygen, you know, and basic bandaging, splinting, lifting and moving, stuff like that. So, and then once you get into the paramedic side of things, then, you know, your doors fly wide open and you actually get to practice medicine and give a bunch of medications, cardiac medications, pain medications. You know, golly, the list goes on and on and on to fix ailments that you may be suffering from.
So we were just talking, too, about the Hippocratic Oath. Is that something just for doctors or
that is physician-based.
Yeah, so it's nothing that you would have to think about.
No, not really. I mean, we fall under guidelines, so all EMS professionals, doesn't matter what level they are, we practice under physicians, so they delegate their practice to us through standing operator or standard operating procedures or guidelines. Mm-hmm. You know, they kind of tell us, once you do your assessment and you decide what's going on with the patient, this is what you're allowed to do and how you're allowed to treat them.
I see.
So, yeah, and Texas is great. Texas is a medical director, and I can only speak for Texas. I've been in Texas my whole life. But we're a medical director delegated state, so really a physician could have me do anything that he deems me competent, and I'm free to practice that in the field.
And that's not true in every state?
No, that is not true in every state. So they have to stick by the minimum standard that for EMTs and paramedics. And so, I'm not sure exactly what Hawaii does down there. I know of Dr. Barnes that runs the paramedic education, and forgive me, I don't know the name of the community college down there.
It's at Manoa, I thought.
Yeah, and she, you know, she would have more information on that. I did get on y'all's Department of Health website and kind of look up y'all's DNR standards and stuff, and it's pretty standard across, I feel. You know, it's like a national standard, I feel. So,
makes sense.
Kind of cool.
Yeah. Well, so what happens when someone's final wishes meet an emergency?
So there's, you know, different, you know, we're going into people's homes. We're going into wherever they may be, whether it be a car accident or in their homes or in the nursing homes and so forth. So, you know, they'll call us, and it's usually because they need us to either provide care. And just because somebody has a DNR doesn't necessarily mean that we can't care for them. We can still give them palliative care,
right?
You know, depending on what's happening with them.
So palliative care is just keeping them comfortable, right?
Correct. Okay. Yes, ma'am. And so we can, you know, if they call us for a stub toe or something, you know, they have a DNR, we're still going to take care of them for their stub toe. But if it's related to, like, their terminal illness or whatever the condition is that they need, I know y'all were talking about advanced directives, too. Mm-hmm. But usually it starts with once you're given a diagnosis and you're not having any, I don't know how to say this without sounding morbid.
Ugh. No, do.
Sounds like two morbids allowed on this show.
Okay. You know, you just, there's no cure. There's nothing more that they can do other than make you comfortable.
Right.
You know, you have advanced directives, but this is before you know, while you're of sound mind, this is what I want done, this is what I don't want, because the resuscitation efforts are very traumatic.
Yeah,
everything that's happening and everything that goes on. And so you have those advanced directives and they go into place, and then you can get a DNR. It has to be signed by a physician, and you have to have that copy with you. Now in Texas, they have bracelets and necklaces too that you can wear. Those are the only accepted forms at this moment that is accepted. So you have to have the paper, you have to have the bracelet or the necklace. Now, that is for an out-of-hospital DNR.
Right, right.
And there's in-hospital and there's out-of-hospital.
Oh, that's the one that gets filed.
Yeah, so that's where all the questions come in. Is, first of all, you're supposed to walk around for the rest of your life with the papers. Second of all, I mean, I don't want to wear jewelry. Jenna paid for me to get a tattoo on my chest that's DNR.
Yeah.
And I learned that
I'm pretty sure that every EMS professional would love to get DNR tattooed on our chest.
But you run out of room on yours, Aunt.
But it doesn't count. What you're saying is it won't count.
So absolutely. It's not legally bound. Yeah.
Oh, we'd have to go to Congress and lobby for that. Because she's saying that somebody clearly...
Or could I have my doctor sign it. Doctor's tattoo under the DNO.
You can sign it with Sharpie every day. Update the date.
I'm not sure that would hold up in court. But,
right. Because I just don't understand how
it'd be hilarious at the mortuary.
How you guys know what the person wants? It's like if they all of a sudden collapse, they don't have a terminal disease. They're just
We're trained to look for paperwork and anything, you know, like when we go into nursing homes, a lot of times if they're a DNR patient, they'll have the DNR taped above their bed on the wall.
By the time you're in a nursing home.
Yeah.
But
in homes and stuff, we do. We have, you know, whoever shows up on scene with us to go look at fridges, beside beds, bedside tables. And if somebody is terminally ill, or we feel that, you know, they have some type of chronic condition that they're not going to recover from, we can usually tell just by assessing them, and then it'll kind of clue us in on what we need to look for. Now, if nobody else is there and we do end up having to go through the full resuscitative efforts, then, I mean, we've done the best that we could with what we had. That legally, it doesn't bind us to any malpractice.
Right.
So, unfortunately, we just do the best that we can. We know to look for that stuff. We train. I actually ended up hurting my leg, and I've got a bum leg, so I can't work in the field anymore. But so now I teach at the collegiate level at higher education, and we teach our students at all levels of EMS to go, you know, look for these things.
So first thing, like if I was collapsed on the floor and someone called 911, the first thing you do, I mean, it's kind of a joke to me that you come running in and say, go look at the refrigerator.
Tell us the protocol. What's the protocol?
Yeah. So if you come in, you're collapsed, obviously we're going to come in, we're going to do our first initial assessment, see if you're breathing, see if you know, your heart is still beating. And if it is, obviously, then we do what we normally would do. If it is not, you know, we will kind of look around for clues. Like if you've got a whole bunch of medicine somewhere, like you've got a chronic disease that you're taking a whole bunch of medicines for and so forth, and we'll start eyeballing around the rooms. You know, usually one of our partners or other people that show up with us can quickly go run into bedside tables, kitchens, kitchen counters, bathroom cabinets. Those are like the most popular places that people keep that kind of stuff. Uh-huh. So we train people we're big on assessing your environment, you know, and making sure that we can kind of look around to our peripheral and see everything that's happening. You know, we don't need anybody jumping out chasing us either. So we have to be really careful about that. And if we don't find anything, then we'll continue the resuscitative efforts, you know, until now. If we feel like you've been there long enough, you know, and there's no signs of what we call dependent lividity, you know, if you're rigor, we're not going to start resuscitative efforts. Mm-hmm. If there are signs of death incompatible with life, like I'd say a car wreck or something, for example, you know, like if your head is not there anymore, we're not going to resuscitate those type of efforts. Or, you know, there will be other signs, you know, that we just won't continue those things. And if we do start, and it's been a while that you may have been laying there down, you know, we will run what they call a code for a certain amount of time, and then we will either call it and go ahead and terminate our efforts. Some places make you call the medical director and call for, you know, to call to terminate resuscitative efforts. It really just depends on where you're from and where you're at. But, you know, you just tell the doctor, I've got this, and this is what we've done, and there hasn't been any change, and he'll be like, okay, time of death is this, and then, you know, there's some stuff that goes on behind the scenes from that.
Yeah.
But basically, you come in and there's more than one of you, and you do kind of figure out what's going on. You don't.
Yes.
So that's clear.
Yeah, we do our best, you know. And as much as I'd loathe to admit that age really isn't a factor either, because we've got a lot of young people in their 20s, 30s, and 40s that have chronic diseases that are terminal, and they're not, you know, even kids. I hate to, and it's man, that's a bummer.
It's sad, yeah.
But, yeah, usually there's caregivers around, and they'll tell you. Now, if you show up and your caregivers are there, but they have a DNR, you know, the only thing that can keep us from not honoring that DNR is if that caregiver has medical power of attorney. because then they can pull that DNR.
Mm-hmm.
But if they don't have that, then we still have to honor the DNR. And then our focus shifts from who we were called for to actually to the family and the caregivers, because then now that they are now our patients, you know, they're having to mentally go through all the stuff that happens.
So the only thing that would be, since my tattoo is not going to work, so I would need to get like a bracelet or a necklace or something.
Yeah.
Yes, or carry that paper. Some people will take empty pill bottles and roll it up and put it in the empty pill bottle and carry it with them on their person.
Yeah, because you would check their purse for meds.
Yep.
Right, so that's the part that I was unsure of, is like, do you come running in and immediately, you know, break open their chest and get them breathing, or do you look around and, like you said, you assess it? It's kind of a much more rational thing than just coming in and saving lives.
Right. We're taught a lot about death, and unfortunately, we don't save as many as we would love to. Although when I thought I got started, I was going to save the world and save everybody, you know. But death is a part of life, and we just have to.
Yeah, and some people are ready to not be saved. You know, it's please don't save me.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you know, I kind of have that same thought process. Like, if you know I'm brain dead, which there are signs that we can tell, you know, that you have a brain injury or that you're brain dead, and we're not doing any good in what we're doing. Because our goal in saving everybody really is to make sure that whenever they are back and they come back to us, that they are neurologically intact, you know, which means they can be a productive member of society and they can function on themselves, not be comatose.
Yeah,
so that's what Jenna was saying, is like, she wants to be resuscitated because she's young, except if she knows, if they know that she's not going to come back a whole person. So they do take that into account, which is another valuable piece of information.
Does this come up? Does this come up for you often? Do you get to on the scene places and then find, oh my gosh, they have a DNR. Stop.
There have been a couple times, and it has, especially whenever, you know, there's first responders that are out there. You have like your volunteer fire departments or, you know, smaller departments that will do first response, and they go in just with BLS stuff. And then, you know, the paramedics show up and they're like, okay, what's the story? And, you know, one of the first questions that's always in our mind is, do they have a DNR?
Yeah.
You know, and so we are intentionally like trained and get on autopilot to learn and know, like, okay, before we do anything more invasive, where are we at?
Yeah, that's your first question, but, kind of thing.
Correct.
Oh, that's correct. Wonderful to hear you say all that, because it's been so confusing to, you know, what, because you are there to save us and you do wonderful things, but like I said, what if you don't want to be saved? Then and how do you find that silly paper on the refrigerator if, you know, that's the, so that's kind of the good news to hear that. But if I have like a bracelet, do I have to have the doctor's signature on the bracelet?
No, that bracelet is just signifying that you have a DNR in place, and the paperwork can be dealt with later, I guess is a good way to put it.
Okay.
You know, but so if you have a DNR from your physician or, you know, PA or MP or whoever your primary provider is, ask them about a bracelet or a necklace. And again, I'm not quite sure what Hawaii's standards are, but it's pretty, I want to say it's pretty national that bracelets and necklaces are in place. And you could probably maybe just wrap it around your purse strap, or, you know, if you just carry like a little wristlet or wallet or something, if you're not big into wearing a whole lot of jewelry or.
Right.
So,
I wouldn't call that jewelry, but I guess it is.
Now, they have a lot of med alert bracelets, you know, for your diabetics and your epileptics, people that have seizures and low sugar and at all.
So you could have a whole, like here in Hawaii, people have these beautiful gold bracelets, you know, and a whole bunch of them on their arm. And
one for each of your ailments.
Yeah, you could have.
There you go.
Bangles.
Yeah.
These are DNR bangles.
Yeah. I mean, that's really the only one that you would need on there from that point.
Yeah, exactly.
Don't give me sugar.
Yeah, maybe you should get one of
and
these.
And they might have a seizure. And
one of these, like this, with the carving in it. Carved DNR.
She, Jenna just showed me her beautiful Hawaiian bracelet. And
nice.
And she was laughing and saying she could have, instead of her name and her Hawaiian name or her son's Hawaiian name, which is what they usually are,
yeah,
she could just have beautiful DNR written on them. And then the doctor to call. Oh, that's fantastic. Thank you so much.
A medical power of attorney can override the DNR. And what works for DNR and a way to tell people that you have a DNR is wearing a bracelet or a necklace or having your paper on your person, your palu palu paper on your person. And what else would you like to add about DNRs and, like, you know, what is something else that we should know about that?
You know, I can't think of much. They're pretty straightforward, you know.
Sure.
I don't. There are nuances to it though, because somebody can say, yes, go ahead and do CPR on me, but don't stick a tube down my throat to breathe for me. Just use a regular mask, you know. They could say, no, I don't want any medications to help start my heart. Just do CPR. Now, CPR in itself is pretty brutal, but don't, you know. Have these conversations. I know it's difficult and I know it sucks, but you've got to have these conversations with your family, with your loved ones, with your friends, you know, whoever you surround yourself with, and your physician or whoever it is that you go see. And don't wait till it's too late.
Because even if it's on paper, at least your husband might have heard you say, don't stick a tube down my throat.
Yeah.
Or,
yeah, and if somebody has medical power of attorney, because you're not of sound mind or whatever the case may be, to make those decisions for you, you know, hopefully you've expressed them with them. So in the event that, let's say, something is happening and they have to call and we show up, you know, and they're like, well, I have medical power of attorney. They should have paperwork with them. You know, they have to produce that paperwork. And I know she didn't want this and this and this. Then we honor that. Now, a lot of times, depending on the service, they'll call their medical directors to make sure. And even our medical director can get on the phone with family and be like, okay, you know, this, you know, they'll ask them some questions and so forth, and they'll tell us whether or not to start or not start, or just make sure we're doing this and not doing that, just to have that MD or DO behind us, you know, to kind of back us up and what we're deciding to do.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, have those conversations. I know it's scary and it sucks and nobody wants to talk about it, but you got to.
That's what our show is about.
And educate yourself.
We love to talk about
it.
We want to talk about it. But what I wanted, so you just raised another question, is I don't know that there's, you know, those in those subtle, you know, like, do I want a tube but not of this? You know, do I want a heart? You know, it's like a menu of, like, I guess, do you put that on your directive?
It's part of this directive.
It's part of the directive?
Yeah, ours has check boxes. See, she actually filled one out and she forgot.
Right.
It's a good thing we got that paper.
Y'all's has to be, like, printed out on a lime green paper or something I was reading about.
Yeah.
I thought that was pretty interesting.
You're kidding.
There should be check boxes in there about, you know, I don't want to be intubated, which means we're going to put a tube down your throat to breathe for you.
Okay.
Or, you know, you don't want any cardiac medications, or, you know,
artificially administrated nutrition.
Feeding tubes. Yeah. And
it's
and
on here.
Pre-hot.
Yeah.
Feeding tubes really don't.
That's right.
The pre-hospital world, we really don't mess with feeding tubes. You know, we don't insert feeding tubes. We don't feed people through, you know, we're not giving them nutrition through feeding tubes. We really don't get involved with that type of stuff until it comes.
You're in the hospital for a prolonged
amount
of time.
Yeah. And that's usually like a nursing facility or, right. you know, nursing homes or so forth that deals with the nutrition and stuff. But that can all be part of your plan, you know, with your death plan, essentially. But
you're not going to be hungry if you collapse and they come running over. It's
like, yeah.
Oh, feed that
person. We're usually called because your brain stopped, your heart stopped, or your lungs stopped. Or all three. So that's usually whenever we get called. But as far as the nutrition stuff, that's more of a long-term in-hospital.
Yeah.
Or and people can be on nutrition or, you know, we call them PEG tubes at home. Because that's the only way that they can get it with home health or however that looks for them. Okay. But we don't really, we stay out of that realm. So we won't even care about that.
On the Pulsed, which is Providers Orders for Life-Sustaining Treatment. It's a backup. Yeah. It's a backup document that goes with your advance directive, and a lot of times that's the one that's filled out by the doctor. And he's got medical interventions, full treatment, selective treatment, or comfort-focused treatment. And that's also the part that gets into the nuances of things. You know,
comfort part.
Yeah, well, full treatment is the primary goal of prolonging life by all medically effective means. So that means I'm going to do whatever I can to try to resuscitate you. Selective treatment, goal of treating medical conditions and restoring functions while avoiding intensive care and resuscitation. That would probably mean that we had a death plan somewhere.
Yes.
Right? Yeah. Because there would be even more nuances that went along with that.
Right.
With choice B. And then C, comfort-focused treatment. The primary goal of maximizing comfort. So you're getting, you know, pain relief and medication.
Pain management.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Oxygen.
Yeah, they'll probably, you know, give you some oxygen just to be a little more comfortable in pain medication. Now, I will tell you that the comfort care is going to be more palliative and more for hospice type situations. You know, they won't, if somebody is on hospice or...
You don't need the hospital for comfort care.
Right. And we usually don't get called for that.
Yeah.
You know, if somebody, they know somebody's, you know, could go any minute or any day or whatever, they usually don't call us.
Yeah, you're emergency.
Yes, ma'am.
Here, they end up calling sometimes. I think we don't have a central coroner in our state, so our county doesn't have a coroner. So everybody's being pronounced dead through the hospital. So they get on the ambulance and take an ambulance ride and go to the hospital and get pronounced when they're at the hospital.
Really?
Which is a crazy,
yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Crazy, really? Ineffective no, way to do things. Unless you were on hospice or you have this paperwork, you know, a Pulster and advanced directive, it's really hard for the, you know, because what, the cops are going to show up and be like, yeah, okay.
I'm really curious about that, why EMS couldn't call their own medical director to just honor
and, then it's,
and not say, well, I mean, I could get into...
Well, our EMS is definitely not like being, it gets dispatched through contract from the hospital, but it's not like a leg of the hospital.
Yeah. Are you going to go to the fire department? What does the fire department
all
have to do with
all the first responders.
It? Our fire departments or who?
I mean, so Deidre, I guess this is probably where the nuance of an EMT versus a paramedic comes in. Like an EMT would probably be a guy on the fire truck. But the paramedics show up next, and they're in the ambulance.
Okay, so first you call 911, and the EMT turns up, and that's the fire department.
Could be.
Unless the ambulance gets there fast enough. You know, fire may not get dispatched, but, you know, it really just depends on who shows up first. But sometimes ambulances are an EMT and a paramedic partners.
Oh, okay.
You know, so, yeah, it just depends on the surface, but. Mm-hmm. That you work for and the needs of the community. So that's all politics with city and county and, you know.
We live in such a small place that the fire department's like 10 minutes from me and the ambulance will take over an hour.
Well, and then if the ambulance is on one emergency, they dispatch the other one from another town and they have to come. And then it ends
up... Truck it all the way.
Yeah, two ambulances are on the... North Shore and there's no ambulances on the east side. And
The fire department's right there. So,
yeah.
It seems like that.
Some fire departments require that they're firemen be paramedics too. So it's really just getting to know your community and what they,
who is what, you know, and how they designated it all.
Yeah. But the police, it's mostly the fire department. The police don't really have anything to do with caring for somebody, like if they collapse, like an EMT. Yeah. An EMT would be much more the fire department than...
Correct. Now, if they're suspicious that somebody is dead, then it becomes a crime scene. Like every DOA, you know, which is dead on arrival or dead on scene, is a crime scene. So cops usually always go to those. But if they're not, if it's just, you know, going because somebody collapsed, the police usually don't.
They even have to go for that. To the hospital here. And even if it's not DOA, if someone dies in the hospital and it's been less than 24 hours, the police have to peruse the room and the body before it's even taken to the morgue.
All crime scenes. Uh-huh. You're right. Proven otherwise.
Death is a crime.
I know, that's why I don't like, you know, I my goal was to always not ever have anybody die in my ambulance or my helicopter, because now it's a crime scene.
You know? Oh my God, that's crazy.
I worked on the ambulance and then I got into critical care medicine on the helicopter for a little bit. But I don't, you know, if I don't think that there's going to be a good outcome, then I wouldn't even try to transport and I'd just call them and terminate my efforts.
Are you in Fort Worth?
No, I'm outside of the Waco area. But when I was on the ambulance, I was everywhere from San Marcos, Austin, San Marcos. And then when I was flying, I flew all over Texas.
Really?
So,
Oh, that's cool.
So you were real busy, huh?
Yeah.
I try to be. Then I got older and got smart and said, I need to slow down a little bit. So.
I know.
But I love, you know, I love the teaching part aspect of it, you know, and this comes into a lot of it because I have to teach critical thinking and I have to teach compassion, and compassion is lost in this world today.
Wow.
So, and it's
that's part of your having, curriculum? Is teaching
that's part
compassion.
Of hers.
That's part of mine, yeah. I have very high expectations for my students because I want them to go out there and you know, be better medics than I ever dreamed of being. Wow. And I think I've done pretty good. So, you know.
Well, it sounds like you're doing pretty good.
Yeah. We do, you know, we do a lot of training on death and dying, and we do a lot of training on delivering bad news to families that, you know, your loved one is died. You know, we can't use passed on, we can't use gone away, we have to use those hard words, like we teach them to do that because we don't want any false hope, we don't want, you know,
when you're in a traumatic experience you easily misunderstand those.
Yes,
and
absolutely.
I've heard that be an issue when all the things like passed on and all those different ways that they say it being an issue, and I never quite understood why. You know, because passed on is a nice phrase, but it's because they have to, you have to be really direct.
Yeah, you have to be stern because their emotions are high, and, and sometimes they're not thinking straight, you know. Wow. I mean, people get combative, people start yelling, people get mean, people, you know, start having their own health problems, and now we've got more patients. I mean, which is fine because that, our attention has to go to them because we know, you know, going through the whole grieving process for that. And it's a lot. We do medical school that most physicians do in 4, 5, 8 years in a year.
Wow.
It's like mini medical school, I feel like.
Yeah, but
field
you learn enough.
School. You know? Like you're not going to have all these machines in the field.
Right.
Here's the 10 things you got to know.
you would be really surprised, you know, what we can practice, and I think a lot of it has to do with that too, is like education of the public. A lot of people still think that we're just ambulance drivers or hearse drivers, and you know, we don't. We actually practice medicine, and we can fix you sometimes before we get to the hospital. Minus, you know, fixing legs or, you know, trauma bones. We'll leave that for the surgeons. But
oh man, I bet you've had
a lot of things
intensely bittersweet. Things happen in that little ambulance box back there.
Oh, yeah. There's been a lot of good, a lot of bad, and a lot of in between. You know, it's really hard. So, I will have to say delivering babies is probably the coolest thing.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
The other end of it, right, for sure.
Well, yes, unfortunately, but you know what? I've also delivered a stillborn, too, and they had no idea, which really, really sucks.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
But well, that brings up a whole another deal, you know, like having to deliver that news that, you know, your baby's dead.
Yeah.
So innocently.
Yeah.
Well, I am so impressed, and I'm so grateful to you. I've just learned so much, and I have so much respect for what you do and what the people like you do. I never imagined what it entailed, and so
that's true altruism.
And teaching compassion is like a big one that really impresses me.
Yeah,
critical thinking.
I mean,
you sound like your father when you say that. I teach critical thinking and compassion.
Her father?
Yeah. The critical thinking part, for sure.
What did your father do that he taught critical thinking? Is he a professor or something?
He's just a very logical fellow.
Oh.
Yeah, I was raised by a couple of hippies. So they taught me pretty street smart. My dad was actually a house husband, but he was kind of a jack of all trades. He did everything. He was disabled, so he stayed home and raised us. But I mean, he's got some stories, man. You know, he was born in 1938, and he would tell some stories, I'll tell you. But he would just tell you how it is, and no fluff, no nothing.
Do stupid,
you know?
So well.
So, yeah. Yeah.
Do stupid, so
you well. Texans, I swear, you're like another country.
We are.
Yeah, really.
Yeah. And, you know, you can always go by your local fire department and talk to them and ask them, you know, like, what level are y'all? What's y'all's training? You know, I'm in that area. And if you ever get called to me, don't do this.
You know,
right? This is where my paper will be.
I had a joke with Jenna when we were first starting to explore it. I thought, well, do I have to send a letter to every single EMT? Say, so this is Susan Bettner, and would you please?
But she's right. Yeah. You could go down there and say, when you see my face, remember
Here's
this
my address.
Face.
This address comes up, just don't bother coming. No.
Yeah, right. You hear this on the scanner, just don't.
Well, I know it is. Oh, this is so beneficial. Yeah. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, it's fun. I could talk about this all day, I feel like.
So could we. It's our favorite.
You'll do
subject.
Every week.
Yeah, we do.
And they were worried, like, what are we going to talk about next week? Yeah.
We have a list of things that can be helpful and compassionately helpful, too, you know, ways to think about death.
Well, I'm
have those conversations.
I'm glad to hear that you guys do learn about how to talk to families in a crisis situation, because I kind of thought maybe that's just what the victim services lady did. They're like, get her over here because these people are freaking out.
Right.
Yeah, no, in my experience and my students and, you know, everybody that I'm around, you know, we are taught, you know, if we're dealing with death and somebody has died, you know, we are taught to focus our attention now on family or whoever's friends, family, caregivers, whoever is there, you know, because they are now our patients.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So we refocus our attention to make sure that we're there for them. And, you know, I'll sit there and hold somebody's hand for hours if I have to. You know, that's just. Now there are some people out there that aren't that way, but you know, I've learned a lot over the years.
Yeah, you've done it a long time. It does.
Yeah.
Nothing like doing something a long time, learning the innuendos.
Well, I'm glad you've flipped back around and gotten into teaching it. You know.
I mean, it was kind of my only avenue. I can't squat all the way down now, so I can't lift up patients anymore, and that's what keeps me from working in the field. And I miss patient care. I completely miss it. Mm-hmm. And I get to go to the ER with my students sometimes when they're doing rotations, and that's fun. But you know, and I've also dabbled in, this is how, you know, morbid we are, but I've also dabbled into, so I'm a makeup artist on the side as well.
Yeah.
So I get to make people look pretty, you know, and I've also done a couple of postmortem makeup applications for funeral homes, which has been really
So that's really your artistic cool. part. That's the yeah. artist in you, right?
And yeah. then you go and you make do some pretty. Makeup for prom after that, and they're like,
right. I do. I know.
Are you these
know,
brushes just, clean? Just, you're like, yeah. Well,
of course they are. Fine. Yeah, yeah. It's been pretty interesting. You know, there's a lot of paramedics that I know that once they retire from being a paramedic, they go into like mortuary science.
Yeah.
It's just kind of that cycle of life that we're used to dealing with.
Yeah, mortuary science is cool. I was working in the mortuary for a while too.
Yeah. And I have lots of reservations about doing mortuary makeup. Science. Mortuary.
Do you?
Well, just because I think, because I'm an old hippie of sorts, and it seems like us children of the 60s are getting to the point where, you know, like what formaldehyde or what's it called, embalming someone
yes.
was only made up so that you could bring dead people from the war back so that you could have the body.
Mm-hmm. It preserves them, yeah. On next week's episode, we're going to talk about
it. No, I'm not kidding.
We talked about that last week, Deidre.
next one is going to be about green burials. And about transitioning from, you know, mortuary.
I'll have to listen in.
Yeah, really? Yeah. Oh, you can Google
it. I will.
Just go to ChatGPT. Everything I'm going to say is on ChatGPT.
Whatever, she's going to forget what she read it's, on ChatGPT.
It's all out there about how, you know, how to do it different now. Because,
yeah.
You know, it's
going to be like, how to get in trouble at a home burial from ChatGPT.
Right. How do you hide the bodies so they don't come in?
Hey,
so
a lot of physicians are getting through school these days.
In mortuaries?
No, through ChatGPT.
Right. Yeah. Well, no, and that was my favorite joke is, what do you call a guy who makes a D in college? You call
Still
him
a doctor. Yep, absolutely.
Times are changing, as they say, right?
Well, thank you so much for joining us on the Death Cafe, Deidre.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me. It's been an honor.
And bringing your positivity and light to everybody that you service in-house and teaching everybody caring, compassion, and critical thinking when you're actually teaching these guys to go out on the beat.
Trying.
And what else? And gosh, I mean, we're old now.
I know.
And I'm older.
And she's older. It's literally probably been 25 years since Deidre and I have seen each other.
Wow.
Yeah.
At least.
Yeah. Well, we're having a 30-year reunion next. I don't ever go to those things, but.
What? Who told you that?
So.
I'm the president.
Are you? I don't know.
Am I supposed to plan a 30th year reunion? Shoots.
No. I have no idea.
Yeah,
I just know 30 years is coming up next year, and I moved out 2 weeks after graduation. I haven't been back since.
I moved out 2 months before graduation.
Well, come here for your 30 years.
Yeah, okay.
We'd love to host you.
I know. And, I'm a beach lover. I don't know why I haven't been that way yet, but
you have two friends here now, and you have places to stay.
So awesome.
Come over next year.
Awesome.
Planet.
I need to. Maybe sooner.
Yeah.
Yeah, really.
Southwest flies from Dallas. It's easy.
I'd love to meet you.
Nice.
You are my hero right now.
Be a pleasure. Well, thank y'all so much, man. It's been such an honor. Talk about those hard talks. I'll have them all day long.
Well, thank you so much, Deidre. I appreciate it. I'm glad our lives are continuing to intersect. And
I know.
I'm glad you're out there doing the good work.
Amen.
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. Yeah.
And I'm glad you got a day off from the makeup counter and rodeo and momming for an hour. Thank you so
that was
much
yesterday.
For your time.
I know.
What's your kid doing? Barrel racing? What are they doing?
She does all of it. Barrel racing, goat time, pole bending, breakaway speed, like I don't know what she
cool.
She can do it, she'll do it.
Is she like 16 now? How old is she?
Well, I've got one 17-year-old who's fixing to start her senior year, and then my rodeo girl, she's fixing to be a sophomore, and she'll be 16 in September.
Oh, right there, both of them.
So, and then, and then my boy, he's out of the Army now. He's been out of the Army almost 2 years, and he's got a wife and a kid, and
cool.
He's off living his life.
You're a grandma.
I am a grandma.
Good. Oh, that's great. Well, always so glad to hear everybody doing good, and thank you for helping us.
Yes, ma'am.
have this conversation. Yeah, absolutely. And I appreciate you. I'll be in touch.
Yeah. Okay. Awesome. Thank y'all. Y'all have a great afternoon.
See you at the reunion. I better get planning that.
I better so.
Thanks for the 30-year date reminder. See ya.
Bye. All right. Bye.
I love her.
Yeah. She's cool.
She's wonderful.
Yeah.
I had no idea. I knew I needed to know about the EMTs. Because I knew nothing.
I didn't even know there was a difference between an EMT and a paramedic.
Yeah.
That's how...
We both learned a lot today, right?
That's how stupid we were. Listen to that.
Well, uneducated. Nobody knows enough about that.
Somebody's calling in. Hold on. Let's see who it is.
You're kidding.
KKCR. Okay. Yeah, no problem. Uh-huh. Bye. The next show is going to be 5 minutes late, so that's okay. We'll play a song. Well, I have a country song planned since Deidre's calling us from Texas.
Good idea.
So I'm going to go ahead and play it. Happy Sunday, everybody, and we're going to let Willie Nelson take us out with the song Still Not Dead. Again today.